With the latest agriculture news from across the state and nation, it's time for the AgNet News Hour from AgNet West. Here's your host, Danielle Leal.
Hey everyone, Danielle Leal here, and thanks for getting your agriculture news with me today. Vast rural land purchases in Solano County stir concerns at a hearing. Farmers and their advocates say the state should seek to protect agricultural resources and open space amid concerns raised over a company buying large swaths of farmland in Solano County. At the state capitol last week, the State Senate Agriculture Committee held a panel discussion on navigating threats to California agriculture. The discussion was inspired by a venture known as Flannery Associations, LLC. Since 2018, the group, backed by Silicon Valley billionaires, has amassed 400 parcels spanning nearly 55,000 acres of agricultural zone land near Travis Air Force Base. That was today's California Farm Bureau Food and Farm News Report, and now let's get into today's show headlines. Water rights and SGMA's role with each other. California's groundwater and surface water systems are completely separate. However, Andrew Genasi, executive director with San Joaquin County Farm Bureau, says water rights and water regulations, such as the Sustainable Groundwater Management Act, have correlation.
You know, their surface water is a whole different system. You know, your Groundwater Management Act, SGMA, while you will use, in a lot of areas, you're going to use your surface water as a balance to offset groundwater pumping. You know, you'd much rather use surface water than overdraft your aquifer, right? So in the areas that do have strong water rights, a lot of the pre-1914 kind of rights, large irrigation districts, you typically don't see as much pumping. And that's why, like, in the Modesto area, that Modesto Irrigation District, Turlock Irrigation District, a lot of those were kind of the second row. They weren't the overdrafted. They weren't as bad. So they didn't have to comply with SGMA quite as fast because they've had surface water for, you know, 100 plus years. So they've been able to, they haven't had the pumping you've seen in some areas that didn't have quite as robust access to surface water. And that, you know, so it is, the surface water will exacerbate or make worse issues with groundwater, you know, our lack of access to it, as we see in the South Valley, when there was plenty of water available on the state and federal system to people, they didn't pump as much groundwater and you didn't have subsidence. And then you can see in the records, you know, going back, there were huge issues back in the 20s and 30s with subsidence. As the state and federal programs came on, subsidence largely disappeared for the most part. And then as the changes in availability of water have happened over the last, you know, what, 25, 30 years, as less and less surface water was available for growers, people switched and turned to groundwater, and which has led to subsidence issues reemerging. So, and we've shown that if there's enough surface water, we can largely get rid of these groundwater issues. The question is, do we have the political will to change that? So, which largely we have shown we do not.
Stay tuned as we'll hear more from Genasi later in the show today. But for right now, here's AgNet West Brian German with more agriculture news.
The California citrus industry could be facing some additional competition in the domestic market. President of the California Citrus Quality Council, Jim Cranny, said that Egypt is looking to access the U.S. market, which raises some concerns for the industry.
So the beginning of this year, around January or so, there was an announcement from APHIS that they had received a request for entry into the U.S. market by Egypt for oranges and tangerines. So they published a pest risk assessment, and we commented on that back in January. So that's what is at play right now with Egypt. And this is a very big threat to the California citrus industry because the fruit that Egypt produces is very low cost in terms of their production, and they could land very cheap fruit in the U.S. market that would be directly competing with California production. And Egypt has a very mature and advanced industry. It's about twice the size of the California citrus industry. They export all around the world, and they're known as a very difficult competitor around the world. In fact, we've run into market competition from Egypt in some of our main export markets. So they're a very difficult competitor.
I'm Brian German for AgNet West Radio Network.
You're listening to AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leo. We'll be right back in just a moment with more agriculture news.
Why do we have GMOs? Actually, we've been modifying crops for thousands of years to prevent crop loss from pest and weather damage, to grow more food on less land, even to improve nutrition. Today, GMOs are developed for the same reasons. With genetic engineering, scientists can change and improve crops more easily and quickly. Feed your mind with more GMO facts on FDA's website.
Welcome back to the AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal, tossing it right on over to Sabrina Halverson with today's National Spotlight.
In today's National Spotlight, while speaking at the recent Farm Progress Show in Decatur, Illinois, Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack put the spotlight on USDA programs.
The Department of Agriculture has a number of tools that are incredibly important in terms of being able to build an alternative to the notion that there's only one option for farms in this country, which is they need to get bigger or eventually they need to get out. I think we have put in place with the work of the Congresswoman, the passage of the American Rescue Plan, the Bipartisan Infrastructure Law, the Inflation Reduction Act, and the use of CCC, we've created and used the tools provided in those bills to create a significant number of alternatives, from climate smart agriculture to ecosystem service market participation to the ability of farms to provide excess energy to co-ops that are transitioning to renewable sources, to more processing capacity in this country, to local and regional food systems that are growing up all across the country, to more use of the federal procurement resources as we buy food for food banks and schools to make sure that the local producers are engaged and involved and benefit from those market opportunities. We'll be announcing in the near term additional awards in our fertilizer initiative. We've already awarded 21 awards. We anticipate a significant number of more awards in the near future. And of course, we're excited about the opportunity for bioproduct production from agricultural waste, specifically sustainable aviation fuel. So I think there's a tremendous opportunity here. And as we look at the Farm Bill, my hope is that the resources that we're currently using from the Inflation Reduction Act and the resources that we will use in the future from that act stay in the act and provide the opportunity, that tool. I'm hopeful that there isn't any effort to restrict the ability and capacity of the department to use all of its tools, including the Commodity Credit Corporation, and that we'll continue to work with members of Congress on both sides of the aisle to try to find creative ways to try to deal with the challenges of putting a farm bill together. And we're hopeful at the end of the day that the Senate Ag Bill represents the model for our future budget, knowing full well that it's going to be a tight budget because of the debt ceiling negotiations and legislation.
Secretary Vilsack was asked about the CO2 pipelines, the tension between the future of the ethanol industry and eminent domain, and farmland.
Well, full disclosure, my son is engaged and involved in one of the companies involved in one of the pipelines. Additional disclosure, when I was governor of Iowa, the legislature passed legislation that limited significantly the power of eminent domain, which I vetoed. So, putting that on the table. Let me answer it this way. I think it's important that we as a country figure out a better way than we have up to this point of how we get along with each other and how we understand that there's a balance between what I want and what we need. That balance allows for the appropriate use of tools with appropriate due process, appropriate standards and requirements, so that there is, if there is in fact a common purpose, that it can be advanced.
That's today's National Spotlight. I'm Sabrina Halverson for AgNet West.
Thanks, Sabrina. And now for today's livestock report, here's Randall Wiseman.
Well, in today's livestock news, various representatives from the dairy industry are in Carmel, Indiana, continuing to provide testimony and discussion of proposals to update and improve the federal milk marketing order system. National Milk Producers Federation Senior Director of Economic Research and Analysis, Stephen Kane, explains what this process is all about.
We're looking to update and really modernize the system to make sure that it's in line with how milk is marketed and priced today. So we're looking at a few main pieces here. We're looking to go probably about 6 weeks long, where USDA has a tentative hopeful deadline to finish it up by the end of September. We'll see how that goes. We'll see if the government shutdown happens later in the year. That might cause some hiccups or some bumps in the road. But so far, we're moving along. It's going a little slowly. We haven't had a major update like this in over two decades. So it's time for an update, and we're trying to make sure we do it right. So it's going a little slowly, but we're making progress and moving through a lot of the key issues here to make sure that the orders are operating as effectively as they can.
And during a recent interview with the American Ag Network, Kane explained what it is that they're hoping to do during this process.
Really what we're trying to do here is we're not having a major overhaul of the program. For folks who are in tune, the word reform gets kicked around a lot. This is not that. This is more of just a modernization of the orders to make sure that they're in line with the industry today. So again, two decades since we've had a major update, a lot of the pieces in the orders are just out of date. Some of the pricing formulas were pegged to some static milk composition factors. The industry has moved forward. We're getting more and more components out of milk than we ever have before, and the formulas in the order aren't representing those increased components in the milk, and farmers aren't getting the full value for the milk that they're producing. So that's one of the major pieces that we've covered so far this hearing, updating the skim milk composition factors, just to make sure that farmers are adequately being compensated for the milk that they're producing. That's been a major key piece so far. We've also been looking at some protein components in the Class 3 milk pricing formula. A lot of words there, but at the end of the day, what that is looking at is taking barrel cheese out of the protein component formula. It's currently being overvalued in that formula, and again, paying farmers less than the value of their milk that's going into produced cheese. But now we're getting into updating what things are called the make allowance, or the manufacturing cost for producing certain dairy products around the country. Those, again, haven't been updated in a very long time.
Then following USDA's initial presentations, the hearing will launch into discussions of specific issues that includes milk, composition, survey, commodity products, along with Class 3 and Class 4 formula factors. Learn more about this on the National Milk Producers Federation website, nmpf.org. I'm Randall Wiseman for Agnet West.
You're listening to Agnet News Hour by Agnet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leo. We'll be right back in just a moment with more agriculture news.
You're going to need me.
You're going to need us.
All of us.
You're going to need our help with your water, your air, your food.
You're going to need our determination, our compassion.
You're going to need the next generation of leaders to face the challenges the future will bring.
And we promise we'll be there when you need us.
Today, 4-H is growing the next generation of leaders. Support us at 4-H.org.
You've been listening to the Agnet News Hour by Agnet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. Welcome back. We've got more of the day's agriculture news right now.
Changes to import regulations for horses. That's coming up on This Land of Ours. USDA's Animal and Plant Health Inspection Service announced the finalized amendments to its import regulations for horses. The amendments will better align regulations with international standards and allow more flexibility for permitted imports while continuing to mitigate the risk of bringing equine diseases into the United States. The regulations also provide APHIS with more regulatory authority to enforce standards for transporting horses. The changes include increasing the amount of time allowed for horses to be in a contagious region without testing upon their return to the United States from 60 to 90 days. The amendments also update ports designated for the importation of horses, adding requirements for health certifications and requiring that horses transiting Central America or West Indies comply with the same regulations that apply to horses directly imported from those regions, given the greater risk of equine diseases of concern from those areas. I'm Sabrina Halverson for Agnet West.
This is the Agricultural Law and Tax Report. I'm Roger McCohen. Form I-9 is an important document for ag employers hiring workers. It verifies the identity and employment authorization of farm employees and protects the employer from penalties associated with improper hires. A new version of the form became available on August 1. All U.S. employers must ensure proper completion of Form I-9 for each individual hired and whether the employment involves citizens or non-citizens. While agriculture is often treated differently under the law in many situations, that's not the case when it comes to Form I-9. There is no exception based on size of the farming operation or for family-owned farming businesses. The form applies to employment situations. It doesn't apply when a farmer hires custom work or work to be done as an independent contractor. A revised version of Form I-9 became available on August 1. The form has been condensed in some instances, and it clarifies the difference between non-citizen national and non-citizen authorized to work. Also, the revised form can be filled out on tablets and mobile devices, and a checkbox has been added for employers to indicate when they have remotely examined Form I-9 documents. Both employees and employers must complete the form within 3 days of the hire. Employers must retain the form and make it available for inspection. This has been the Agricultural Law and Tax Report. I'm Roger McCohen.
Farm Bureau this week named the 10 semifinalists that will compete in the Farm Bureau Ag Innovation Challenge. American Farm Bureau Director of Industry Relations, Chase Heineman, says the teams of entrepreneurs will compete for startup funding.
We're super excited to have announced the top 10 semifinalists for the American Farm Bureau's Ag Innovation Challenge. We've had a really great crop of companies from the applicants who submitted applications for this coveted program now in the 10th year, and are really excited to get them to conventions to compete for much needed capital to help expand their businesses.
Heineman says the program offers competitors valuable training and insights, as well as networking and exposure.
We have some partners that are going to provide some pitch training through Cornell University. We have some opportunities for them to engage with potential funders at convention. They will be able to connect with our members. And then, of course, they'll compete for up to $165,000 in award money that will help them expand their businesses and continue to provide those services and products.
He says the Ag Innovation Challenge highlights unique and creative ideas in agriculture.
The agriculture sector is a sector that's full of innovative ideas, and people are really trying to meet the challenges, not only that farmers and ranchers are facing, but the entire planet is facing. And we're very thankful for our partners to helping us highlight these innovative companies, Farm Credit being our major partner, as well as our sponsors, Bayer, John Deere, Farm Bureau Bank, Farm Bureau Financial Services, and T-Mobile.
Learn more about the semifinalists at fb.org/challenge. Michael Klimitz, Washington.
National Farm Safety and Health Week is actually one of the longest presidential proclamation weeks in the nation. Actually, FDR signed the first one back in 1944, and it's been continuous since then.
And Dan Needed of the National Education Center for Agricultural Safety says the theme of this year's awareness campaign is No One Can Take Your Place.
Unfortunately, still with the number of fatalities that we're having, or even the injuries, if it's time off, it's not typically like there's another employee that's there on the family farm that can take over those jobs as you heal. They just don't get done to be able to do it. And of course, if there's a fatality, there's a gaping hole, and sometimes it leads to the sale of the family farm.
National Farm Safety and Health Week is traditionally observed during the third week of September. This year, September 17th through 23rd. The timing coinciding with either the start of harvest season or ongoing harvest season across much of the country.
Farm Safety and Health Week is that one week of the year that the media kind of helps along in getting that safety message out, not only to the farmers, but also to the motoring public. Because as we get into fall harvest season, the days are getting shorter, unfortunately, and there'll be farm equipment out on the road. We'll be sharing the road with the motoring public, and they need to understand we need to be out there doing that. We are big, we are slower in moving, and if they just have a little bit of patience with us, we can share the road and both get to where we're going safely.
Daily themes for the week cover various farm safety and health topics, with education provided through available safety resources, webinars and videos, and localized outreach. Topics range from equipment to rural roadway safety, health and wellness, priority populations such as children and the elderly, safety awareness for farmers inside confined spaces such as grain bins, and brain health. Nita notes the importance of partnerships and outreach of farm safety and health messages, whether through the awareness campaign, that is National Farm Safety and Health Week, or throughout the year.
Working with USDA and with the extension offices, there's been some extension offices that have been very proactive and kind of listening to the messages.
Additional information about National Farm Safety and Health Week is available online at www.necasag.org. I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
This is the AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. We'll be back in just a moment with more of the day's national headlines and local reports when we return. But don't forget, if you've missed any of our morning shows or if you simply need to catch the news at a different time, you can always subscribe to our podcast and have statewide agriculture news at your convenience. All you have to do is search AgNet News Hour or AgNet West on your favorite podcast downloading app. That's AgNet News Hour. It's available on both Apple and Android devices.
GMOs? Genetically engineered? Bioengineered? What's what? Well, GMO stands for genetically modified organism. It's the common term many people use for foods created through a process scientists call genetic engineering. And you'll start seeing bioengineered on some food packages to let you know the product or some of its ingredients come from GMOs. Feed your mind with more GMO knowledge on FDA's website.
Welcome back to the AgNet News Hour by AgNet West, providing you with statewide agriculture news daily. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. Now let's listen in to more featured segments.
Harvest continues to ramp up. We look for soybean producers to sell beans off the combine and store corn as we move forward. I'm Mark Oppold with today's bottom line report, brought to you by Helena and by Kloss Equipment. Helena says improve your fertilizer efficiency and increase yield potential for next season right now. Visit HelenaAgra.com to learn more. Weekend rain in parts of the western northern belt moving into the central areas will delay harvest for a day or two, but bottom line analysts say moving forward from here, many producers will aggressively sell soybeans out of the field and store corn. Low water levels on major rivers restricts normal barge traffic. That'll back up beans even more at country elevators. Keep an eye on crude oil. Futures the highest since mid-June of last year. Strong energy prices typically supportive to commodities, so that'll keep a solid floor under corn, soybeans, and wheat. This is the bottom line report. The Kloss Treon 740 Combine was a big hit at Farm Progress Show and recent Husker Harvest Days. A Class 7 machine that proves bigger is not always better. Learn more at Kloss.com. This is Farm Safety and Health Week. Be aware of harvest equipment on the roads and check your PTOs and chains on your equipment around the yard. That's our bottom line. I'm Mark Oppold, wishing you a profitable day and a profitable week ahead.
Creating green spaces in more communities. Gary Crawford reports.
Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack says in talking about efforts to bring high-speed internet to everyone,
no community should be left behind.
But this time he's talking about another effort
to expand investment in urban and community forestry.
Vilsack was in Cedar Rapids, Iowa Thursday to announce a $1 billion investment for 385 projects to plant trees and increase access to green space for millions of Americans who don't have that access. Vilsack told reporters with programs like this,
we believe that we can create more resilient communities in terms of the impacts of climate. We think we can mitigate extreme heat incidences and events in many of the cities where projects and awards will be made.
Vilsack said tree canopies have been shown to reduce average temperatures by up to 19 degrees. Gary Crawford reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
And I'm Sabrina Halverson for AgNet West.
Salmonella in poultry. This pathogen is a leading cause of foodborne illness.
Salmonella bacteria cause an estimated 1.35 million infections in the U.S. each year, not only foodborne, but across numerous products and other contexts. The most recent report from the Interagency Food Safety Analytics Collaboration estimates that over 23% of foodborne salmonella illnesses are attributed to poultry consumption, specifically almost 17% for chicken and over 6% for turkey.
Those numbers provided by Agriculture Deputy Undersecretary for Food Safety Sandra Eskett at this year's USDA Agricultural Outlook Forum. So how is USDA and partners in government, industry, and academia combating salmonella?
We announced in October of 2021, USDA's, FSIS, and the Office of Food Safety, that we were going to undertake a reevaluation of our strategy, our policies, our regulations related to salmonella contamination in poultry.
The reason? While the number of chicken samples detecting salmonella decreased over a five-year period to 2021, the estimated rate of human salmonella infections from all sources has remained constant during that same time period. That has led to several meetings and studies among stakeholders over the past 2 years. University of Minnesota professor Craig Hedberg offers one view from the academia perspective.
The challenge for us is to improve our methods of surveillance, to focus on the pathogens that actually are causing illness in people and look for those in our meat and poultry products and understand the dynamics of how humans are being exposed to those organisms that lead to the occurrence of illness.
Independent food safety consultant Robert O'Connor offers the perspective of the poultry industry regarding efforts to curb salmonella.
Even the current regulatory framework, I walked away from a lot of processing facilities that were Category 2. So with all my experience, you would think I'm only working with Category 1 plants. Is categorization a good measure of the efforts that a company puts into controlling salmonella?
Michael Taylor, a former Food Safety and Inspection Service Administrator and now part of a consumer nonprofit organization, provides both a consumer and policy view of what it will take to combat salmonella in poultry.
Poultry companies, independent of the regulatory standards, have been innovating in various ways, particularly some of the leading larger companies have been innovating and trying to figure out solutions to the problem that there are certain serotypes of salmonella that are present fairly infrequently but account for the majority of the illnesses. How do you solve that problem in a complex production system?
I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
This is the AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. We'll be back in just a moment with more of the day's national headlines and local reports when we return. But don't forget, if you've missed any of our morning shows or if you simply need to catch the news at a different time, you can always subscribe to our podcast and have statewide agriculture news at your convenience. All you have to do is search AgNet News Hour or AgNet West on your favorite podcast downloading app. That's AgNet News Hour. It's available on both Apple and Android devices.
Over the years, you've brought them into your home. You were prescribed opioids after the C-section and after Dad's back injury. They helped when you were in pain, and you held on to them, just in case. But did you know holding on to unused opioids puts your family at risk? Trouble with opioids can start at home with unused medicines, such as pills, patches, and syrups. You can remove the risk and protect your family. Find out how at www.fda.gov/drugdisposal.
Welcome back to the show. For today's interview segment, we're airing part two of my conversation with San Joaquin County Farm Bureau's Executive Director, Andrew Genasi. We're talking all about water rights and water legislation.
So you mentioned the word riparian, and there's riparian rights and then there's another type of right. Can you kind of give me the difference between the two?
I mean, there's riparian and then there's like the state water board right system, if I'm understanding the question correctly. So riparian means you're along the river. So as long as you are in a contiguous block along the river and have been exercising that right, you have right to that water, to pull water off the river. Now, it's not a unlimited right. You know, you have to be using it for beneficial use, and it can't be pulled off the river and then sent, inland to different parcels. Like, it has to be contiguous parcels owned by the same person right along the river. There's very strict rules on how riparian water can be used. You can't subdivide and then, push that water across your property to another property, to somebody else's property. You can't sell that water outside there. But that water basically means you're right along the river. It's a river right or stream, and you're able to pull natural flow. And that kind of becomes important. It has to be water flowing that was naturally there. And even that, like I said, I'm not a water lawyer, but as I understand it, it's, you know, the further up the river you are, the earlier you get to pull your water. So I'm not a riparian expert by any stretch. That's how I understand it. But yeah, it's you have to be pulling water right off the river. The other water rights are you are off the river. Usually you have some kind of impoundment, whether it's a dam, you know, some kind of storage area, and you have rights to that water, claim to that water is the other rights you would be looking at. So not right along the river, but you're off the river, but you're still pulling water from a body of water, some kind of impoundment. Okay. So.
California agriculture, there's a lot of generational producers, farmers and ranchers, and they will, you know, hand down their operations and their land to, you know, maybe their children or their grandchildren. But sometimes land gets sold. Do the rights, are they connected to the land, or are they connected to the owner? And so when an exchange of land happens and a new owner gets that land, do they inherit those rights, or how does that work?
Usually. Most water rights are held by an irrigation district. You know, non-riparian rights are held usually by a group like a Modesto Irrigation District or Turlock Irrigation District. You know, the rights are tied to the land, but they're held kind of almost in trust by these larger organizations that manage that water for the landowners who are part of that irrigation district or water district. So in those cases, it's tied to the land. If you have a small pond on your own property, or you can in some areas you can sell water out of basin, your right to that surface water, you can market that. It kind of, those rules really depend on where you're at, you know, which irrigation district, which groundwater basin you're in. Those rules are kind of basin by basin. But over the last, I don't know, dozen years, it's really, in most areas, really ratcheted down on your ability to move water outside of a basin. People pretty jealously guard that water, because it's a big factor when you're going to do your paperwork for your groundwater management. Having that access to surface water and having that water to remain within basin to be used not only on your crops, but if you got a deep percolation, you're recharging your groundwater basin. People want to protect that. So it's getting tougher and tougher to move water outside of a basin.
Right. So speaking of groundwater, what roles do these, you know, like grandfathered in water rights, or as you mentioned, rights all along that list of our system, what role does it play when it comes to dealing with regulation like the Sustainable Groundwater Management Act? You know, how do they stack up against each other?
They're kind of separate, as I understand it. You know, their surface water is a whole different system. You know, your Groundwater Management Act, SGMA, while you will use, in a lot of areas, you're going to use your surface water as a balance to offset groundwater pumping. You know, you'd much rather use surface water than overdraft your aquifer, right? So in the areas that do have strong water rights, a lot of the pre-1914 kind of rights, large irrigation districts, you typically don't see as much pumping. And that's why I like the... In the Modesto area, that Modesto Irrigation District, Turlock Irrigation District, a lot of those were kind of the second row. They weren't the overdrafted. They weren't as bad, so they didn't have to comply with SGMA quite as fast because they've had surface water for, you know, 100 plus years.
Right.
So they've been able to. They haven't had the pumping you've seen in some areas that didn't have quite as robust access to surface water, and that, you know, so it is. The surface water will exasperate or make worse issues with groundwater, you know, our lack of access to it, as we see in the South Valley, when there was plenty of water available on the state and federal system to people, they didn't pump as much groundwater and you didn't have subsidence. And then you can see in the records, you know, going back, there were huge issues back in the 20s and 30s with subsidence. As the state and federal programs came on, subsidence largely disappeared for the most part. And then as the changes in availability of water have happened over the last, 25, 30 years, as less and less surface water was available for growers, people switched and turned to groundwater, and which has led to subsidence issues reemerging. So we've shown that if there's enough surface water, we can largely get rid of these groundwater issues. The question is, do we have the political will to change that? So, largely we have shown we do not.
Yeah. So they're indirectly related, but not directly related.
Yes.
You're listening to AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leo. We'll be right back in just a moment with more agriculture news.
We want everyone to breathe clean, healthy air, but California's traffic and mountains don't make it easy. Our mountains trap pollution, making us more vulnerable to dirty air. Today's farmers are voluntarily doing their part with help from USDA's Natural Resources Conservation Service. How? By replacing older diesel-powered tractors and equipment, treating dusty farm roads, avoiding open burning, and more. Can't afford it? NRCS has invested $178 million helping California farmers clean our air. They can help you too. NRCS, helping people help the land since 1935.
You've been listening to the AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. Welcome back. We've got more of the day's agriculture news right now.
Raise One and Sunpreme raisin varieties still appear to be viable options for California growers, and this year more is being learned about their long-term potential. Ranch manager for Marthadol Enterprises, Austin Humble, said that as with most other commodities in California, the timeline for grape production has been pushed back by about 2 weeks. That delay, Hubble explains, has prompted a new approach to harvesting their trial varieties this season.
As the varieties still continue to show promise both as viable raisin varieties and potential candidates for self-drying, one thing we are working on this year that I think we're actually going to try to harvest the grapes by machine onto continuous tray without having done any cane cutting because they are a spur pruned variety. And we've always suspected that that's going to be a tool in our back pocket for a year like this, where, yes, the ultimate goal is to dry the raisins on the vine. If that is not going to work, we're hoping that growers would still have a continuous tray mechanical harvest process as a tool to ensure that they can get their crop dry in a reasonable time frame. And so that's something we are likely going to be implementing this year. And we're interested and curious to see how that works out and how that compares to other continuous tray dried varieties that we often see here in the Valley.
I'm Brian German for AgNet West Radio Network.
State ag departments set their policy priorities. The National Association of State Departments of Agriculture set priorities for the upcoming year during its annual meeting. NASDA will advocate to give USDA more authority to be flexible in serving farmers and ranchers who often face challenges in seeking disaster assistance. NASDA members also want existing gaps in the insurance coverage and federal disaster relief programs closed to protect farmers from an increasing number of natural disasters. Members will also advocate for standards that ensure clear and consistent labeling for cell-based meat products, also referred to as cultured meat. During the meeting, NASDA also adopted a new policy of supporting laws that protect farmers' right to farm. The new policy advocates for protecting agricultural and forestry operations from nuisance lawsuits. NASDA members also amended the organization's policy to support increased investments in apprenticeships and educational programming because of a tremendous need for workers with training specializing in the agricultural fields. NAFB contributed to that report.
Dairy Management Inc. is accepting applications for a new dairy product competition. The competition seeks innovative dairy product concepts and is open to undergraduate and graduate students in the U.S. The theme for the 2024 DMI New Product Competition is innovative dairy-based products for health and wellness consumers. The theme aligns with Checkoff-led insights that show consumers are seeking dairy products that deliver health and wellness benefits, including those related to digestion, immunity, joint health and mobility, and overall general health. A combined $27,000 in cash prizes will be awarded, and the deadline to make submissions is January 15, 2024. The winning teams will be recognized at the American Dairy Science Association's annual meeting in June of next year. More information about the competition is available at usdairy.com. I'm Brian German for AgNet West Radio Network.
Farmers show high interest in harvest autonomy. Farmers in the U.S. and Canada appear to be embracing autonomous technology to optimize their operations and boost productivity. A survey conducted by Forward Group revealed that 65% of operators surveyed expressed enthusiasm for adopting autonomy solutions, while 29% showed high levels of enthusiasm. The survey findings emphasize the positive impact of autonomous solutions on farming efficiency, profitability, and sustainability. 67% of the farmers intended to adopt autonomy technology by 2027, with 47% planning integration into their operations by 2025, provided the technology proves effective for the tasks. The survey also shows that 59% of farmers believe the autonomy will bring significant value to their carting operations. A substantial 51% of respondents expressed trust in autonomy technology for their harvesting. The driving factors behind the growing interest include 42% of the farmers interested in the technology wanting the autonomy to increase their productivity. And AFB contributed to that report.
To get more information on the topics you heard today, visit AgNet West online at agnetwest.com. You can also stay connected by following us on our social media at AgNet West on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. You can also find our broadcast team of Danielle Leal, Brian German, and Sabrina Halvertson on Facebook and Twitter. Thank you for listening to the AgNet News Hour from AgNet West. AgNet West Radio Network, your primary choice for agriculture news.